Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The acting director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons was fired this week in connection with the apparent suicide of accused and disgraced financier and registered sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Department of Justice also reassigned the warden at the New York Detention Center, where Epstein apparently hanged himself, and two staffers who were supposed to be monitoring the unit have been put on leave. The event has cast a spotlight on suicide in prison. If someone like Epstein is overlooked, what about others? We're talking about the fallout and the incidents of suicide in prison today. Kevin Johnson is a Justice Department correspondent for USA Today. He's been covering the issue. Welcome, Kevin Johnson.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Epstein apparently hanged himself in prison. What's known about what happened so far?
Well, last week, as some of your listeners may recall, the medical examiner in New York released her findings, which had been delayed a bit for what she described as further study, but found that it was indeed a suicide by hanging. Mr. Epstein apparently used a bed sheet to hang himself. There were questions that arose during the after the medical examiner had conducted the first study of his death. They moved to study it further before releasing their findings Friday.
This past Friday, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And is there any video or any kind of video or photographic evidence from the scene?
That would be extremely helpful, but video inside a cell is typically not allowed for privacy reasons. There are cameras that watch the hallways out in front of cells and hallways, but actual video inside cells are typically not allowed.
What is the typical protocol for a case like Epstein's? Anybody who had already apparently attempted suicide in jail before?
Well, generally, after a finding that a person had committed suicide, and on July the 23rd, your listeners may recall that Epstein was found in his cell by a cellmate at the time, and he had injuries to his neck. The authorities were alerted. He was placed on suicide watch at the time after that incident, but was removed several days later, and that the decision making around that that action is now part of the Justice Department review by the Inspector General, and there's a separate Bureau of Prisons administrative review underway.
Is there any documentation to explain why he was taken off suicide, quote unquote, watch, as they call it?
Well, there is supposed to be some interaction and communication between psychologists and prison authorities when those decisions are made. We have yet to see the documentation or explanation for those decisions, and now those are part of this ongoing review.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The Department of Justice has reassigned the warden at the New York Detention Center where accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein apparently hanged himself. And it's also placed on leave two staffers who were supposed to be monitoring his unit at the time. And the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons was also let go this week. My guest is Kevin Johnson. He's a Justice Department correspondent for USA Today. He's been covering the issue. We're talking about the issue of prison, of suicide in prisons and jails. It's on the uptick in recent decades. If you have a question or comment coming up later in the program, we'd be glad to hear from you. 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. One of the things that people have blamed is staffing. What do we know about staffing issues at that particular prison?
Well, staffing at that particular facility have been below authorized levels for some time. In fact, I think there were in excess of 30 or more vacancies at the time of Epstein's death. But that is not unusual across the system. There have been deep deficits in personnel, particularly officers, the people who actually patrol the hallways and do the work of monitoring prisoners across the system. It's become so bad in recent years, actually 4 years, that the Bureau of Prisons has approved a process of what they call augmentation, in which they now deploy civilian workers, teachers, secretaries, cooks, electricians, plumbers, to do the work of corrections officers. And it's not a unique practice. And again, it goes on across the prison system around the country and was in place at the time that Mr. Epstein died.
Why the shortage of corrections officers?
Well, there was, as you'll recall, a hiring freeze that followed President Trump into the White House. He loosened the reins on a number of agencies, but kept it in place for the Bureau of Prisons. It drove down personnel staffing levels precipitously. The government shutdown didn't help that at all. They lost a number of employees during that particular time. The hiring freeze was lifted back in April. Attorney General Barr, after coming into office, recognized the issue and indicated that hiring freeze had been lifted. So they are hiring now, but over a long period of time, they've had no pool of new applicants to draw from and have been suffering from attrition as well as a lack of new candidates in the pipeline.
What do we know about why the dismissal so far up the food chain, all the way to the acting director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, as well as the warden at the detention center? If these shortages of staffing are all explained, and staffing shortages, what a lot of people think is the problem, why? What do we know about why so high up?
Well, I think this was a recognition of the problems being very severe, both not only at that facility, which had documented problems with staffing and deployment for years, but when you look at what the levels are across the system, I don't know what the AG was thinking at the time, but apparently he had to be taken into account that that the prison system was grappling to head off a 5,000 staffer deficit across the system, and the system had been without a permanent leader for more than a year. Director Inch, who was the last permanent director, resigned abruptly after a very short time on the job. And so I think there was a recognition that the entire system needed some leadership and stability.
And now there's a new acting director, right?
No, there's actually the Attorney General appointed a permanent director.
Okay, I thought that she was acting. Okay.
The previous director was acting, Hugh Hurwitz, a longtime prison official, very smart, able guy who rose up through the ranks, but was serving as a temporary director at the time. But A.G. Barr sort of reached back into his past, and when he was Attorney General the first go around, he picked Kathleen Hawke Sawyer, who was the director during his time as Attorney General back several years ago, and has renamed her to the post, and she becomes director. He's also reached back to find another former deputy director, and that person will assume the job of deputy director.
Going back to when you were talking about the staffing augmentation, where secretaries and other non-correction officer personnel could take on the role of correction officer to fill staffing. Was there any special protocol when it came to that augmentation, when it came to special cases, cases of people potentially on suicide watch? Did it matter, or are they given leave to take on any of the duties of the correction officer?
Well, as far as we've reported, we have done some extensive reporting on this aspect, and we found that there didn't appear to be any discrimination at all in terms of where these what they call non-custodial staffers were deployed. We talked to Bureau medical personnel, one a nurse who was told that she was going to be deployed as a corrections officer, and was handed a ring of keys and had no idea which doors those keys opened at the time that she was provided the keys, which stunned her, us as well. But that apparently is not an uncommon occurrence in the system.
In the federal system.
Right.
How does the workers' union respond, the prison workers' union respond to all of this? Is this stuff that they agreed to?
Well, it's under all staffers, according to the Bureau of Prisons, are viewed as actual corrections officers because they do get some training. Everybody gets sort of basic training coming into the system, which includes some security training. But obviously, when they report for their jobs as secretaries, as teachers, as nurses, as physicians, even clerical workers, it was not their idea that they were going to be patrolling recreation yards, cafeterias, and units in solitary confinement. Their jobs were to do what they were hired to do. And so they rarely had any additional training to do security jobs. And the union has been very vocal about the use of this practice. And in fact, lawmakers have called for an end to it frequently. Just last year and in years prior, there have been calls for the Bureau of Prisons to end this practice. But because staffing has been so low, they've had the wardens at some of these facilities have seen it that they have no choice but to tap this group of employees to work security jobs.
You said that the Trump administration has lifted the hiring freeze for the Bureau of Prisons. When did that happen?
In April.
Just this past April.
Yeah.
Okay, Kevin Johnson, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Kevin Johnson's a Justice Department correspondent for USA Today. He's been covering the issue of prison suicides and protocol in the federal prison system when it comes to suicide prevention and staffing and all the other issues that revolve around what happened to Jeffrey Epstein, who has been ruled as a suicide from a couple weeks ago. We are going to continue our conversation. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The fallout over the apparent suicide death of disgraced financier, registered sex offender, and accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein has cast a spotlight on the incidence of prison suicide. The U.S. Department of Justice reports that the rate of inmate suicide has been increasing over the last two decades and is now the leading cause of death in U.S. jails and prisons. Austin Serrett is a professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He recently wrote about the issue and who's responsible when an inmate dies by suicide. We'll post a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Austin Serrett.
Thank you for having me.
Cameron Lindsay worked for corrections for 25 years. He's a former warden of three prisons, one in California, one in Pennsylvania, another in New York. He has also worked in private prison systems. We welcome him as well. Welcome, Cameron Lindsay.
Thank you.
Cameron Lindsay, given your experience in the business of imprisonment, what was your reaction when you heard that Jeffrey Epstein had died behind bars at the federal detention facility in New York?
Utter shock, very frankly.
How so? Why?
Well, it's just such a basic function. I mean, I guess as a leader, as a correctional leader, administrator, you have to exercise sound, prudent correctional decision making. And what I see in this particular case is there was a failure with that. When the homicide of Whitey Bulger occurred back, I think it was last October, and then when the suicide of Epstein occurred, I was just absolutely shocked because, I mean, more than anything, they needed to keep this individual alive, and he had many, many reasons to want to be dead.
You're shocked because of the notoriety of the inmate and that extra precaution should have been taken, because we bear in mind as well that the rate of suicide has increased over the last 20 years.
Suicide in jails and prisons is unquestionably a huge issue. And we have absolutely got to do something with respect to the way that we incarcerate people. That's a whole other subject that we could spend a lot of time on. But certainly suicides in jails and prisons, it's a prevalent factor. We've got to do something about it. But the thing with Epstein is the leadership of the facility just should have known that he, being Epstein, would have many reasons to want to harm himself. And clearly, after he had a legitimate suicide attempt, once he was placed on watch and under direct and constant supervision, it's my belief that he should have stayed that way until his case was adjudicated and he went to an institution where he would serve a sentence. He would not have been at MCC New York indefinitely because he was pretrial, pre-sentence inmate.
Austin Serrett, you wrote about who's responsible when an inmate dies by suicide. Talk about where responsibility does lie ultimately.
Well, that is a very broad question. Mm-hmm. Prisoners are in the care of the state, and what the law has recognized for a long time is that state officials have an affirmative duty to provide for the safety of those inmates. So at the most abstract level, putting aside the particular details of the Epstein suicide, we can say that whenever a suicide happens in a jail or a prison, that the state and the facility is to some extent to blame. Now, I say that to some extent because I don't think that the law requires perfection, that the law requires that there be absolute safety in the prison, but the law does require that the efforts that are made are reasonable and prudent. And obviously, in the Epstein case, that was not the case.
Is there any particular obligation when it's such a notorious actor as Epstein was?
I think that the obligation of prison officials to the inmates that they supervise does not depend upon how notorious that person is. Mm-hmm. The law doesn't differentiate, doesn't require that special treatment be given to high-profile individuals. Now, it may be prudent as a matter of prison policy or the policy of a jail to give extra attention to high-profile inmates or inmates for whom there is a special reason that we want their testimony or appearance in court. But no, I think the law regards all inmates as kind of equal in the eyes of the custodial institution.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about who's responsible when an inmate dies by suicide, inspired by the recent death by suicide of Jeffrey Epstein in a federal prison in New York. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Just heard from Austin Serrett. He's professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. He recently wrote for The Conversation about this issue. If you have a question or if you want to check that out, we'll have a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And also with us, former warden in three states, worked as in corrections for 25 years, Cameron Lindsay. 614-292-8513 is the number. Robert in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Ann. I'm calling in regards to the Jeffrey Epstein mm-hmm. case. I personally, as being somebody that has been incarcerated, has had suicide thoughts, has been on suicide watch before, first of all, I'd like to say they make those jails, the cells, very, very hard to commit suicide, and they engineer them that way. And I've even sat around thinking about it during my incarceration. As far as being on suicide watch, pretty much to get off of suicide watch, all it takes is you telling a psychologist that, yes, I no longer have thoughts or feelings of harming myself, and then you will come off of suicide watch. And I believe that's probably what ended up happening with the Jeffrey Epstein case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jeffrey Epstein case. And as far as suicide prevention in general, I personally feel, as somebody that has had suicide thoughts many times, that there is no real prevention to it. If somebody's going to do it, they're going to do it regardless. And if Jeffrey Epstein is going to tell them what they want to hear to get him off of the suicide watch, then that's what he was going to do it. And even if they kept him on supervision, then once he got adjudicated and went up to the real prison system, then he probably would have attempted it and done it there.
Well, let me ask Austin Serrett, is it that simple? Do we know what the process is? Would it be just, I won't hurt myself, I promise, and you can get taken off suicide watch?
The process for getting off suicide watch is not all that complicated. And I do think that the caller has a really important point, which is that there are limits, of course, to what can be done in a jail or a prison to prevent an inmate from killing himself. But I do think we want to take a step back and actually think about what's happening in jails and prisons. Much more likely to commit suicide in a jail than in a prison. And the rate of suicide in American jails is 3.5 times what the rate of suicide is in the general population. I think that's to some extent because of what is called the shock of the first contact with incarceration. It's not unusual for people to try to kill themselves in anticipation of a trial. Indeed, the median time in American jails for a suicide attempt is 9 days. Mm. So it tends to happen pretty quickly. But the caller has something. I think he's right. Suicide is often a spontaneous act. There's only so much you can do to prevent it. But I must say, I don't think American prisons and jails are doing all that they could be doing to prevent it.
What else could they be doing, do you think?
Well, the conditions of confinement in American prisons and jails are not something about which Americans should be proud. They're violent places. They're difficult places. Second of all, the custodial staff are often overworked and undertrained. Indeed, the rate of suicide among correctional officers itself is something to be concerned about. And perhaps most importantly, mental health services in many states in the United States in prisons have been cut back. So I think more effort could be put in to to training guards, to alleviating some of the conditions of confinement, and to investing in mental health services.
Cameron Lindsay, does that ring true for you as well after your experience?
Absolutely. I've heard nothing that I have disagreed with. Absolutely nothing. Couldn't agree more.
Then I go back to your original comment, Cameron, that you were shocked. Did Jeffrey Epstein's death, was that more, or Whitey Bulger's for that matter, is that a function of the notoriety of the characters, and that than it is the larger circumstances in prisons and jails?
Well, two things. I mean, those two particular incidents you referred to were instances of failed leadership, in my opinion. But with respect to the issue of suicide, I've worked as an expert witness, mostly as a plaintiff expert, and I've done it for the last 5 years, and I've done a lot of suicide cases, and it has really been an eye opener. And this is subsequent to spending 25 years actually in jails and prisons. Mm-hmm. In the last 5 years, I've seen some atrocious things, and it's been a real eye opener, especially in rural detention centers, whereas adeptly pointed out a minute ago, there's a lack of training, there's a lack of leadership, there's a lack of experience and skills and knowledge. Again, we have so far to go in terms of incarcerating people the correct way.
It's surprising to hear, just as a layperson in all of this, about the augmentation policies of the federal prison system. Austin Sarah, what are your thoughts about that, that they can use people who are like secretaries and cooks and things like that to perform the duties of corrections officers?
Well, again, it is an unfortunate fact of American life that we incarcerate more people per capita than virtually any other nation on the planet.
Right.
And we don't tend to invest the resources commensurate with the ways in which we incarcerate. The life of a prison guard, the life of a custodial guard in an American prison or jail is a very, very difficult one. And, I don't want to draw the comparison to school teachers, but when we think about what we're asking them to do, just the way we might think about what we ask school teachers to do, and we look at what we pay them and how they are treated, I think that's where a lot of the problem lies. And as we were just talking about jails, detention centers in the United States, especially jails at the local level, have become alternatives to what used to be mental institutions in the United States.
Right.
So the mentally ill are now found more in jails than the jails are able to deal with them. And again, that reflects what I would describe as a kind of disinvestment in the efforts to ensure that mental illness is treated and coped with.
I agree.
Joan and Marion, you're on the air. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I maybe have a different perspective here on this case with Epstein. I feel that I have a conspiracy theory that this was an inside job, that there was help from the very top. That's why all the top people have been fired, because somehow there was an agreement to assist in this suicide, because if Epstein went to trial and was questioned, he could implicate so many people that would then be implicated in this sex scandal thing. Mm. And so I fear, or I think, that this was planned in some way and worked through the prison system.
To her point, Cameron Lindsay, when something like this happens, obviously the conspiracy theorists are it's a well-known topic, but it does give rise to questions and a lack of trust in the system.
Sure does. That's why these two events, Bulger and Epstein, were just such a monumental disappointment to me, because I came up in the Bureau of Prisons, and I have always known it to be a sound correctional agency. I even wrote a book about a year ago about my experiences in the Bureau of Prisons and spoke glowingly about what a professional correctional organization it is, and I believe that. But they have lacked leadership at the top for a long time. And when you have, when the government or a state engages in an act of just incredible incompetence or stupidity, obviously it's going to give rise to the conspiracy theories. So I understand why the caller would feel that way. I don't believe that's what happened, but I certainly understand that's how and why people would think that.
Austin, Sarah, is there a reason to question, though, along those lines that Joan is talking about in her call?
I don't believe so. I don't think anyone would have had an incentive within that prison to conspire to allow Epstein to commit suicide. After all, look at the consequences, which they could have anticipated for his suicide. You know, it's difficult to disprove conspiracy theories. It's especially difficult to disprove conspiracy theories in high-profile cases. But I think that the greatest, I guess, disproof of that conspiracy theory is the very sad fact that suicide in jails and prisons is so common. If it were unusual, then I would say, well, something must have happened. But even though he's not the first high-profile inmate to take his own life, so I think it's the very pervasiveness of suicide in jails and prisons which suggests probably no conspiracy here.
Well, I want to thank you, Austin Sarrett, for joining us today. I appreciate your time. I'm sorry, you're going to still stay with us, Austin Sarrett. Sorry about that. Cameron Lindsay works with corrections for 25 years in three states, former warden of three prisons and two jails. Cameron Lindsay, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
We will continue our conversation with Austin Sarrett, professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. And we welcome your comments and your questions. 614-292-8513. We're talking about the incidence of suicide in prisons and jails. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the question of protocol when it comes to suicide risks in prisons and how the issue is being addressed in the wake of the death of accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. He apparently hanged himself in a New York detention center a couple weeks ago. Still with us is professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts, Austin Sarrett. He recently wrote about the issue for The Conversation. We'll post a link to that article on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Dr. Mark Siegel is a medical correspondent and clinical professor of medicine at New York University Langone Medical Center. He's worked with suicidal inmates and wrote about why Jeffrey Epstein deserved better care. Welcome, Dr. Siegel.
I'm not sure I like the word deserved.
Okay.
Jeffrey Epstein, who he was, but I think anybody deserves a certain protocol of care that everyone in the mental health profession, especially the psychiatrists I know, would want. And this was clearly an aberration in that regard.
You know, we were talking earlier about the protocol when to take somebody off suicide watch, and former prison inmate called in and others concurred that it really is just a matter of saying, I don't feel like self-harm anymore. I'm good. It's pretty easy to be taken off it. So what do you think the protocol should be?
Well, first of all, it's prison officials that are deciding this rather than physicians. I want to know what psychiatrist was advising them in the prison. and what he based his decision on, because we think of mental health as an ongoing concern. So, I want your listeners to understand this point. How do you get from being suicidal one day, and then, you know, you're in prison in a place where there's rodents running around, and, you know, people are threatening you, presumably, and you have to put money in their commissary accounts, presumably. You know, you have a cellmate who's threatening you, and then suddenly you're fine, and you wave your hands and say, I'm no longer suicidal. I mean, if I were a psychiatrist in that situation, I'd be very reluctant to sign off on that. And then to know, of course, that he ends up in a cell by himself with a bunk bed and, you know, people saying they fell asleep, guards saying they fell asleep. The whole thing was such a drop-off in care, and that I've been saying, and I wrote in USA Today in an article out today, you know, why couldn't he have been transferred to a psych hospital or a prison ward? You know, where's the need for such great security? I mean, it isn't a terrorist where that someone's going to, you know, bomb the prison or something. So if they can't take care of him there, put him in a psych hospital.
Austin Sirra, what do you make of that idea?
Look, I think that we need to again draw out a little bit from the Epstein case. I think we could agree that in the best of all possible worlds, in American jail and prisons, at least four things would be done. First of all, there'd be an effort to identify people who are most at risk of suicide. Second, we would hope that once we've identified those people, we could find appropriate treatment for them. Third, we'd want to make sure that they were housed appropriately in the jail. And fourth, we'd want to make sure that they were adequately supervised. That seems to me to be a kind of rational protocol for suicide prevention in jails and prisons. But again, I want to reiterate, American jails and prisons are overcrowded and understaffed, and they are awash with people with mental health problems. So it's not surprising, given that environment, that the suicide rate is going to be very high. It's also not surprising to me that mistakes are going to be made, even for people, prisoners like Jeffrey Epstein, where there's a lot of public attention.
I'd like to speak to that for a second, Ann, mm-hmm. if I'm
sure.
A couple of points that are relevant to what he just said, and I think he's 100% right. But I want to point out that one out of three deaths in prisons are due to suicide. Suicide's the number one cause of death in prison. So that speaks to his point. But against it is the fact that this particular prison, the Metropolitan Correction Center, has only had one suicide in 40 years, and that suicide was by a gangster 21 years ago. So it's not known for it. And I don't know why it isn't known for it, given what happened here. So yeah. I think his larger point is correct, which is it's not the right place to be taking care of suicidal patients, especially someone that's a sexual predator who's being targeted for sure. So I don't know what the solution is, but in such a high-profile case, I think the solution would have been to get him out of there.
You know, when we talk about these staffing issues in the federal prison system, and even though they in April ended the hiring freeze that had been in place since Donald Trump took office, is there, Austin Sirra, any kind of constitutional obligation? Does this fit into any other arguments about what the system owes not only the inmates in it, but also the victims of the inmates and who are counting on them to be supervised properly?
I don't know that there's a constitutional handle to encapsulate all that you've just said. Obviously, inmates have a right against cruel and unusual punishment, and they also have a right to conditions which are safe enough to avoid reasonably foreseeable harm. But when you bring the victims in, I think it's important to say that, you know, prison suicide is obviously a tragedy for the person who commits the suicide, no matter what the crime was that they committed. Mm-hmm. But it's also, and I think this is what your question indicated, it especially in the pretrial context, it's a tragedy for victims who are waiting to see justice done. And post-trial, when a sentence has been imposed, we all have an interest in seeing that sentence is fully served. And suicide on both ends, before the trial and after the trial, obviously represents the end or the interruption of those legitimate interests.
Do we know if suicide is more common pretrial?
It's very common pretrial. And again, that's why I pointed out earlier that the rate of suicide in jails is higher than the rate of suicide in prisons. Many, but not all of those who commit suicide in jails are there awaiting a disposition, awaiting a hearing, awaiting a trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to add something here, because I'm not just talking theoretically. I want you to understand why I'm making the points I'm making. I think everything that Austin is saying is 100% correct. But I think in this situation, this is such a high-profile case, and there were so many victims that want justice here, rightfully so, I believe, that, you know, the fact that the system is so bereft and that there are so many suicides is a very good reason to have not taken him off suicide watch and to have considered transferring him, which, by the way, is done all the time. I don't want you to think that isn't done. It would have been a special case, but I have treated many prisoners who have come from prison because they were suicidal or severely depressed, so they can make such a transfer.
You know, when it comes to, you know, given your work with suicidal inmates, is there anything you can tell us about patterns of what's driving them to that? Is it this prison itself? Is it prison life? Is it remorse? Is it anything? Is there anything we can look at to draw some conclusions or categorize?
It'd be obviously on a case by case basis. Yeah. Using the Epstein case as a pattern, I would really doubt there's any remorse there. It sounds like a very hardened sociopath, from what I can tell. And I think that would be common in cases of sexual predators. I think it's more a panic of someone that falls off a cliff in terms of lifestyle, what they're used to, and suddenly they're in a cell. You know, he was reportedly sleeping on the floor. I mean, imagine rats running around, a billionaire. And you know, he had lawyers that were meeting with him to get him out of the cell into a meeting room. I think it's the culture shock of change. I mean, I'm interested what Austin thinks about this, but I think it's a culture shock of change and then facing the future. What are you facing? How many years is this going to be, and how am I going to handle it?
Yeah. Austin Sirrett?
Well, I fully agree. That's what I refer to as the sort of initial shock of confinement. I think that's right. But I also want to try to draw again away from the Epstein case. I think that, you know, there's a tendency when a kind of high-profile event happens that grabs the headlines to want to just bore into that case. And by the way, I think it's important to do that. But I think what's really important is to draw away from that case and to think about this broader problem, which gets very, very little public attention. And that is that the rate of suicide in jails is 50 per 100,000 people. In the general population, it's 15 per 100,000 people. And so we want to think broadly beyond the Epstein case, as important as that is, and recognize that this is a tremendous problem in American jails and prisons. And as much as we want to figure out what went wrong in the Epstein case, we want to also figure out what can be done so that we reduce the rate of suicides in jails and prisons. Because, Anne, as your question earlier indicated, all of us have an interest in seeing that people who are arrested come to trial and people who are convicted and sentenced serve those sentences.
That's very eloquent, too, and I agree with, again, every word. I would add that Austin's already pointed out some of the reasons for this that need emphasis. The overcrowding in that particular prison, or many prisons, the understaffing situation, the squalor. You know, these are conditions that people are living in across the country, not just in this facility. And so federal prisons need to be really looked at. And simply appointing new leadership isn't going to solve the problem either.
Is there any distinction to be made between publicly run prisons at the federal and the state level and privately run prisons, Mark Siegel?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a very fair point. I think that, well, but both need reforming, but I think the federal prisons in particular are very problematic. I think the privately run prisons tend to be in much better shape. But I think there's a big public health problem here we're talking about. Beyond the mental health problem, there's a public health problem, a problem with, by the way, drug abuse is rampant in prison. So that's one of the reasons I've been so against the idea of being punitive when it comes to drug abuse. This may seem like a different topic, but, you know, 60% of people in prisons have a drug problem. So if you lock somebody up that has an opioid addiction, you're not going to get rid of it or treat it. Rhode Island prisons have been remarkable in trying to deal with that. But I think the whole prison system has to be looked at in terms of the mental health problems, the physical health problems, the infectious disease problems, and the drug abuse problems.
And as I think Austin Sirott pointed out, it's very, very true here as well as anywhere, that jails, which are typically pretrial or predisposition places, are like holding tanks for people who ought to be in psychiatric wards or at least be getting mental health treatment.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And that's even the larger problem to solve. And I think, to his point, using what has happened here as an illustration of a larger problem, we have a very, very poor system of mental health care in prisons that is exemplified here, but it's rampant. And it's not just suicide. It's depression, untreated depression, untreated anxiety. We don't have mental health workers. It doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. There's not enough attention paid to the sense of shame or humiliation. Again, not in this case, I don't believe, but not everybody in prison is a sociopath. So there's the understaffing isn't just in terms of body count. It's also in terms of there being not enough social workers or psychologists or anyone to talk to a prisoner about their concerns.
And this is a nationwide problem, Austin Sirott. What do you? It's an attitudinal thing, as you mentioned. We have more people in prison behind bars in the United States than any other Western country in the world, Westernized country in the world, and we just don't value the people who are put in charge.
No American politician is going to be running in 2020. On the platform of let's do more for prison inmates. That's not a kind of platform that gets you elected or reelected. We need to recognize that the vulnerabilities of people that we incarcerate are so great that pressure needs to be put on the people that run those prisons and the elected officials who appoint them to make sure that the conditions on jails and prisons reflect, instantiate American values. After all, how a society punishes and how it treats the people that it punishes is a great reflection on the kind of society that society will be. And it's a hard thing to do. I'm not suggesting that one needs to be sympathetic to people who are convicted of horrendous crimes. I'm saying that at the end of the day, how they are treated is as much about the kinds of people that we want to be as our concerns and sympathy for the
inmates.
That's
beautifully said, too. I love that point. We have to be caring people. We have to show our compassionate side of the times.
Dr. Mark Siegel, medical correspondent and clinical professor of medicine at New York University Langone Medical Center, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Austin Sirott, professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. Thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the interesting conversation.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.